This is CliffCentral.com.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. Hello and welcome to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. My name is Greg Nicholson, and I've got to admit, I'm a little bit tired today because I was up last night reading this book that's sitting here in front of me. It's called Get Up, Stand Up, Personal Journeys Towards Social Justice. And it was recently released by Mark Haywood, and I'm glad to welcome Mark into the studio today. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Greg. I'm great, and I'm sorry I kept you up.
The recently released book, it's a great read on Mark's 30 years as an activist fighting for social justice. It begins with his childhood. Born in Nigeria, raised in Botswana, educated in the UK, and it charts his early activism against apartheid, the fight for treatment for those living with HIV/AIDS, and his more recent role in litigation, also working to fight corruption and ensure South Africans receive the opportunities they're entitled to and basic standard of living. Get Up, Stand Up includes elements of memoir, history, political analysis, and it ends with quite a painful but frank view of the country and the world. And, of course, being Mark, there's a call to arms for citizens to do what they can to build just societies. There's no need to introduce Mark, but let's go through a quick history. He's currently the executive director of Section 27. He's known as one of the organizers of Save SA, the anti-corruption and anti-xenophobia marches. He led the AIDS Law Project for 13 years, and he co-founded the Treatment Action Campaign. He also chaired the UNAIDS Global Reference Group on HIV and Human Rights, and he served as the deputy chair of the South African National AIDS Council. So obviously there's a lot to get through, but first I want to start, Mark, with your childhood. So your parents were British, and you grew up as an expat in Africa while also studying in the UK. Can you tell me a little bit more about your relationship with your father? You write that you wanted to be everything he wasn't. Can you tell me, how did that influence your belief in social justice?
Well, you're correct. My parents were British. You know, they were sort of a generation of the 1950s British middle working class. And my father comes from Manchester in northern England, from a very working class background. And somehow, by some luck, as far as he was concerned, he got a job with Barclays Bank in Nigeria and moved to Nigeria, to Lagos, in 1963. But, you know, I talk quite a lot about my father in the book, particularly in the early parts of the book, because he carried with him, I think, many of the prejudices of a white working class British person of that period. Prejudices, I think, about Africa as a whole and its prospects for proper, successful development. Prejudices about race. Prejudices about class as well. So, you know, as I started to grow up, and from quite an early age, and as I started to form my own views and views about equality and views about justice, it took much longer to understand class. Then obviously I began to clash with my father, mainly on political issues. But he was also a very kind of strict disciplinarian Puritan man, very strict about money, very strict about what he considered to be moral and immoral about how a young person should live their lives. So, you know, it was a difficult relationship from a very, very early age, and in fact, a difficult relationship almost until he died nearly 2 years ago. I think there was a degree of reconciliation, but the reconciliation was on the basis that there are certain things that you never talk about, because if you ever tried to talk those questions, any political question basically, then it was took you on a road to a pretty nasty conflict. So at the end of his life, I just stopped trying to talk about the real world as I know it.
So there was almost by the end of his life agree to disagree type of atmosphere.
I think so, yeah. I mean, he had kind of come to respect me to some extent. I think I met some of his criteria because I'd become relatively well known for what I do, because I've written, because I occupy a number of positions. So he could tick his expectation boxes on those levels, but he couldn't tick anything on the level of what I actually stand for in the world, which is, you know, is quite radically different from what he stands for. You know, he thought Margaret Thatcher was great. I thought Margaret Thatcher was horrible. He, you know, lived in Botswana and South Africa in the 1970s and early 1980s, and he would never I would describe him as an apologist in some ways for apartheid, not an active endorser or supporter, but he was one of those people who made up excuses. You know, well, black people live better in South Africa than they do in other African countries, so what are you complaining about? That type of issue, which just, of course, grated with me and my experiences.
And then there's also, I guess, the legacy, his ties to the legacy of colonialism, working for Barclays.
Yeah, and Barclays DCO, which stood for Dominion and Colonial Office. He was an expatriate. He worked in Lagos and then in northern Nigeria and then in Kumasi in Ghana and Takoradi and Accra and ultimately in Gaborone, which was, you know, where I was for most of my teenage years. But very much, you know, not a colonial property owner, not part of the bourgeois, part of the paid middle and working classes that were sent out to do the work of capitalism and colonialism in these post-independence societies and to set up their business networks, really.
Now, another key influence of yours is, and you write beautifully about it, your passion for music, literature, movies. Can you just elaborate a little bit for me on how these, when you started interacting with these, and how, in particular, they opened your eyes to the horrors and the reality of apartheid?
Well, you know, one of the perks for my dad of Barclays Bank and working in Africa was that you got to send, so-called perks, was that you got to send your kids back to England to go to school. So I was very fortunate. I was sent to, in England, they call them public schools for some reason. They're actually private schools. I was sent to a very ancient private school that was set up in the 8th or the 9th century, one of the oldest schools in England. And, you know, it was a very, very high quality of education. And very early on, one of the things that I loved in my education was my introduction to literature and to reading. But in the way I was taught literature, in the way that I read, never read it in a passive way. So if I read Shakespeare, then I pulled from Shakespeare what I think was radical and about justice, and as well as the beauty of writing by Shakespeare, you know, the lilt of the literature, the movement, the poetry of it. But literature always talked to me about justice. It seemed to me that everything that I read was political. Almost all great literature, even if it's about love, often is about love and injustice, love and society, class and society. So, you know, I took from literature a map for life, and I used that map to inform how I thought about the world and also what I should do about the world. So it instructed me to action, and that coincided with the time when we moved to Botswana. The family moved to Botswana in 1977, and the first things I heard when we moved to Botswana was about the murder of Steve Biko in 1977. And later, you know, a little bit later, a few years later, the death of Soretse Khama, the first president of Botswana. And so I started to move from being a student of English literature to trying to understand through South Africa's literature and writings of Nelson Mandela, political writings, but also literary writings, what was going on in South Africa. And that just kind of cemented me as a youngster to a commitment to the issues initially, of course, of overcoming apartheid and to freedom and equality in South Africa. But, of course, over the years, it evolved. And I still think that great literature is perhaps one of the most important influences for people who want to believe in social justice. I can't put literature here and music there and painting there and issues of politics and justice somewhere else. And that's what I'm trying to say in the book. Part of what I'm trying to say in the book is that we get into these struggles because we are human beings concerned about the plight of other human beings, and books is very often where you find that plight best described.
One of the lines I wrote down from your book is, literature contains instructions for the living. And you've got quite a few quite direct lines like that in there that I thought were quite poignant. But then you were also growing up in an era when punk rock became quite big in the UK, and there was also a fair bit of turmoil and political changes within the UK, as well as what you'd experienced in Southern Africa. Can you just tell me a little bit about that seeing these guys like
Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious.
That's right, that's right. You know, seeing God Save the Queen and these sort of things. Yeah. It seems like that must have been revolutionary for you in terms of wanting to act out, wanting to rebel, wanting to challenge authority.
Yeah, look, quite a lot of it I made sense of much later, including when I was writing this book. But, you know, here was me in a private school in the middle of York in northern England. You know, York and Yorkshire, once upon a time, industrial, in the early days of Thatcherism, mass unemployment, 1979, what the British called the winter of discontent. And of course, as we were just talking about, the political discontent carried over. First of all, it's perhaps most immediate expression was in music. And along came, in the late 1970s, you know, a band like the Sex Pistols, which absolutely scandalized British society because people like Johnny Rotten used the word fuck on radio. And, you know, they produced an album called Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols. And they tore up all the norms about music, but all the norms about the kind of complacent post-war norms about dress and decency and behavior. They exposed a lot of its hypocrisy as well as its political hypocrisy. So England was suddenly full of people with safety pins in their noses and torn clothes and sometimes Mohican haircuts. And it was a rupture. It was a social rupture that was part of an economic rupture and part of a political rupture. And, you know, I was a coy, scared, middle-class kid who couldn't associate myself directly at the time with those movements. But the power of the music, of this one album that the Sex Pistols produced, the Never Mind the Bollocks album, which got banned, and the God Save the Queen, which got banned, really just went deeply into me and, in a sense, spoke to my own sense of anger, my own sense of alienation from what was going on, even though I was a coward and I couldn't demonstrate it in quite such an obvious way.
If we go back for a second and talk about Steve Biko again, you said when you came to Botswana, that was one of the first things you heard about his. I'm not sure if it was reported as a death or a murder back then, but then you learnt more about the case when I think it was you read Donald Wood's book, Biko.
That's right.
What influence did you have and did that have on you, and how did you feel when you were reading these details?
Well, it shocked me because the one thing that had happened, even though I was the son of British middle-class parents who post-colonial attitudes, I had grown up in Africa, independent African countries that had managed to shake off, you know, racism, institutionalized racism, and where there was equality and where there was freedom. Of course, we have to put both in inverted commas because of what we know about the legacy of colonialism. So arriving in Botswana and suddenly having such proximity to South Africa and to apartheid South Africa was a shock to my naive little 13 or 14-year-old sensibility. And that was obviously compounded by reading about the death of Steve Biko. I don't remember exactly how it was described, but certainly as I started to find literature, ANC literature, liberation literature, you know, it was presented as what it was, the murder of Steve Biko. So that impacted, I mean, I was two things in Botswana, as a kid in Botswana. On the one hand, I was a teenage pissed, if you like, joying in the freedoms of Botswana in a very multiracial society, getting drunk, falling in love, you know. On the other hand, I was increasingly angry with South Africa and increasingly angry actually with the complacency of Botswana society, particularly white expatriate society, which I found myself in. So I began to speak out about that. I began in a small way to rebel about it, to question it. I tell the story in the book about how, you know, one of my first political acts was to grab the microphone on New Year's Eve at the golf club, Gaborone Golf Club, and gather the caddies together and sing Kosi Sikelele Afrika, which, you know, was such a simple, little, harmless thing, but it scandalized and shocked the golf club attendees that night, and my father was made to apologize for it. And, you know, so it was little things, but really it was just the proximity that this thing 20 kilometers down the road over the border was going on, and it was an appalling thing, and I thought very, very deeply about it.
It's almost the inherent contradictions of growing up white, middle class in Africa, but with a conscience, or
exactly
with eyes.
Yeah. And they were contradictions, and that the contradictions created internal conflicts, and they created conflicts within my family and within my surrounds, if you like, as I tried to make sense of these things. Because when you're 13 or 14 or 15, you know, you don't arrive with grow up with a ready-made political understanding or political conscience. You have to try to fathom out what is going on and what you actually believe and what you stand for.
How did your mother respond to this nascent activism?
Well, you know, my mother was an activist in her own way. You know, throughout her career, she taught at schools in Nigeria, Ghana, Botswana. She's always been, you know, somebody who's worked on charitable issues, tried to work against apartheid, against racism, against inequality. But I think, obviously, her approach is a very different approach to the approach that I took. So, you know, when I left university, the point at which I left university and then joined the Marxist workers' tendency of the ANC and kind of went underground in the struggle for a number of years was really a point at which there was a kind of major parting of ways in the ways that you address these problems. Do you address them politely and in kind of a middle class way, or do you actually start to take these things head on? And I believed that it was necessary to take them head on.
So you mentioned the Marxist workers' tendency. So perhaps for this part of the interview, I should call you Peter Davies or Sean Kelly,
which were
your aliases when you joined that part of the movement. You left Oxford. You went to Oxford, which is, I guess, in the book, you know, quite directly engage with some of those other questions you had to ask yourself about the causes you're committed to, but the relative privileges you're able to enjoy. But when you left Oxford and joined the Marxist workers' tendency after certain levels and sort of becoming more and more of an activist, you put an immense amount of unrewarded work into this. You lived in squalor. It seems to be a quite radical devotion to the cause that, number one, you're very removed from South Africa. You were working in the UK, trying to get back here and do work back here. But also, there seemed like there was quite a thankless job. Why did you do this?
Well, I
think a lot of people would think as well. This guy just left Oxford. He could do anything.
Okay, so I had 3 years of ivory towers. During those 3 years, I was very angry about what was happening in South Africa. Remember, this was the middle of the 1980s, 1983 to 1986. It was the time of growing uprising, growing murder within South Africa, growing revolt. By the time I got to the end of being at Oxford, I had absolutely decided that I wanted to be part of the liberation struggle. Whilst I was at Oxford, I had met members of the Marxist workers' tendency of the ANC, who were a small faction allied to the ANC but expelled from the ANC, who argued for, you know, a socialist ANC, a mass-based workers' ANC. And that coincided with my own conversion to Marxism and Trotskyism and, you know, the stuff that you study and you think about whilst you're at university. So they said to me when I left, would I come and work, what we called be a full-timer, a full-time political activist? I said yes. They were in exile working in Hackney in East London. Hackney was a miserable, at that point, very depressed area of London. So I ended up on kind of working-class, dilapidated working-class housing estates. But very, very anxious to prove my worth to the liberation struggle. So I always had a bit of a kind of, not sure what the right word is for it, but, you know, I wanted people to believe in my commitment. I was very conscious both of my race and conscious of my class, and so I felt like I had to go the extra 10 miles all of the time to prove the levels of my commitment. So in those years we didn't receive any pay. I signed on the dole in Britain and got £30 a month or something like that, and literally worked 18 hours a day for the next 3 years with this group of people. On a material level, it was pretty horrible. On a political level, it was fascinating because, you know, this group of people included people like Martin Legasic, now a very well-respected left historian from South Africa who was in exile, part of this group, another person called Robert Peterson, who's a senior counsel now in Cape Town, David Hemson, who worked with people like Rick Turner in the early days of the trade union movement. So intellectually, it was, you know, very, very, very rich and very interesting and very challenging, and that was good enough for me.
And you were mostly producing literature or propaganda, it might have been called, for the dissemination in South Africa.
Yeah, the name of the there was a front organization called the Southern African Labour Education Project. That was the organization we operated under. That organization produced material for the trade unions, for the NUM, for the early COSATU. Just basic, very good quality training and educational and empowerment material for workers and trade unionists. But that was a front for something called Ingaba Yabasebenzi, which was the actual journal of the Marxist workers' tendency of the ANC. And Ingaba was, we produced it 3 times a year. It was a much more intense, much more deeply political, theoretical journal that we smuggled back to South Africa to arm activists with a political understanding of the ferment and the causes of the ferment and the challenges of how to build the ANC and how to overthrow capitalism and so on. So, you know, I was involved probably in producing 10 or 15 for 3 years, 10 or 15 of those. It's still a marvelous high quality. It's not published anymore, but they're in the archives at WITS. Very, very high quality journal. We smuggled it back to people like Zaki Ahmad and other names that are familiar now, who were part of the same tendency but operating in South Africa.
Almost seems like a bygone era for when I'm reading this about the political activism back then and how important it was to have these journals, pamphlets, and so on. And you still see them occasionally at different marches. There'll be a group of very leftist-looking dudes,
yeah,
you know, trying to sell you a little pamphlet, and you're thinking, "What? Who reads pamphlets anymore?"
it was a very different world. You know, that world of the 1980s and the 1990s, particularly the 1980s. You know, before the collapse of so-called communism in 1989, the collapse of the Berlin Wall. So the world was divided between people who thought that capitalism was a good thing and most people who fought for socialism and believed in socialism, but different kind of brands or theories of how to get to socialism. Of course, we were part of the socialist, not mainstream, but certainly part of the socialist movement.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm Greg Nicholson, and I'm here with Mark Haywood talking about his recent book, Get Up, Stand Up, Personal Journeys Towards Social Justice. Now, Mark, one of the interesting things I find with your book is the difference between Stalinism and Trotskyism and within the leftist movements and those pushing for socialism, how that influenced your politics at the time. And when you finally did return to South Africa, I think it was in the late 1980s?
That's right, 1989.
You joined the ANC as an entrist. What does that mean? Can you just break that down for me?
Entrism basically meant that you accepted that the ANC had a mass following and that it was the engine of change and it was going to be the engine of revolution. But you were critical of its leadership because the leadership was a capitalist leadership. And so your job as an entrist was to go into that mass political party and argue for socialist policies from the inside. So to try to shift the mass party, whether it was the ANC in South Africa or the Labour Party in Britain, to try to shift it to the left, to try to shift it onto a socialist program. So, you know, I came back to South Africa in 1989 to do precisely that. You know, I came back and to work with groups of young people from Soweto and from Westbury and Bosmont and other places who were ANC members, Youth League members, but to try to teach them and persuade them about socialism and to warn them that an ANC following capitalist policies would ultimately disappoint the expectations of the mass of people in South Africa and would not be able to deliver equality and freedom and jobs and peace and land, which, although I've changed my views subsequently since then in some important ways, had a high element of truth about it. Mm. Because it, you know, we all, I think, agree that a compromise... Not that the compromise wasn't necessary. The compromise was necessary, and I'm one of the strongest advocates of the 1994 compromise and the Constitution and the 1996 Constitution. But we gave in too easily to demands or pressure that there should not be a deep-rooted economic transformation. And without a deep-going economic transformation, you are never going to solve the social ills of the country.
And that was the work you were doing effectively back then, because it was predicted that because of the ANC's roots in, I guess, institutions and systems like the church and capitalism, it'll be a transfer of power to elites.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, you know, I think the writings of the Marxist workers' tendency of the ANC were very important. You know, people like Martin Legasic were very serious historians, so their historical analysis of the ANC going right back to the earliest years of the ANC was a deep and profoundly carefully thought out and well documented analysis, and it was an analysis that really centered on class, and a large part of the analysis was to point out and say, look, however heroic Madiba may be and most other members of the leadership, they come not from the proletariat, not from the working class, not from the very small peasantry in South Africa. They come from the elites of African society, and the elites are wanting to make a pact with other elites to be treated as equals. So there was some prophecy. Well, it doesn't really prophecy, because you don't have to be a prophet to understand politics.
It's funny that we're still having the same conversations today, or at least recently, when we're effectively talking about the battle for the soul and the heart of the ANC. And you've had some of their leftist allies, or that could be debated, but sort of Kasatu, the SACP, others like NUMSA, or even individuals like Swelenzi Mavavi, coming out very strongly against them, saying recently they've actually, or all this time, they've never been true leftists or never been committed to the socialist cause.
Well, you know, socialism has been a very complex... and has been enormously complicated in the last 30 years or so. As I said, the certainties, which were never really certainties, but what people believed to be the certainties that they held in the 1960s, 1970s, early part of the 1980s, were all shattered when it appeared, and again, stress appeared, that capitalism was triumphant in the 1990s with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the move of China to embrace capitalism, the collapse of Eastern Europe. I think the problem, and I try to say it in the book, is that Marxists and socialists were too dogmatic. They were too fixed in almost religious beliefs, and that they didn't do their proper homework, their proper study of what was going on. And they also didn't think about, okay, in this new environment, what are the levers for social change? And I think that's the question that we confront today. You know, I don't believe any longer that you can nationalize the capitalist monopolies, that's going to bring peace and prosperity and employment to people. I think that we have to much more directly engage capitalism and regulate capitalism in the interests of all of society, in the interests of the environment, in the interests of the planet. But there's still, Greg, a kind of vacuum in many respects in thinking about the left, and where there should perhaps be a much greater degree of consensus about how do we achieve social justice. There's enormous fragmentation and sectarianism, which is a terrible problem. And the people who pay the price ultimately are not middle-class leftists, but the poor and the working class.
You're very well known for your work in HIV/AIDS activism. And you got into that work through groups like the AIDS Consortium and the AIDS Law Project through very well-known individuals now, such as Zaki Akmat and Edwin Cameron, Justice Edwin Cameron. But I get the strong sense from your book that rather than these individuals or simply wanting to be involved in activism, and now we're talking the 90s, we're talking after the transition, or during the transition, I suppose, I get the strong sense in the book that the key motivation for your work on HIV/AIDS, and obviously I should say you also work with the Treatment Action Campaign, the motivation seems to be the people you met, the people you met who passed away, people whose children who passed away, the many people who are suffering without help. Can you just, am I correct in saying that? And can you just elaborate a little bit on, was that a key driver for you? The people who are affected by HIV/AIDS, the ones who died without treatment, their families.
You've read the book very well. And I'm glad you've understood it in the way that you've understood it. No, look, I didn't ever expect to become an AIDS activist. I was drawn into AIDS activism, as you correctly say, almost by accident, by Zaki Akmat. But in 1994, and, you know, Zaki had been infected with HIV and introduced me to the AIDS Law Project. But, you know, what has inspired me was that when I started working in HIV in the early years, I found a group of people who were beautiful people, basically. Very heroic, very courageous, very isolated, often because of the stigma around HIV, very determined to try to build a response to HIV in the context of a society that either persecuted people with HIV or just didn't want to hear or know anything about it. And it was working with people and working with people living with HIV that just inspired me, but it also took me back to what we were talking about earlier on, about people's inherent dignity. I think about, you know, people's capability of doing good, of acting in solidarity with other people, of having empathy with other people. So that was where I got my power from. You know, I didn't think that I would work on HIV for more than a few months, but the deeper that I got into it, the more of a sense of responsibility, I guess, I acquired, that I've been drawn into a very special circle of people. And they're not dependent upon Mark Haywood or anybody, any other single individual in particular. But neither could you just, knowing the scale of the problem, neither could you just get up and walk away from it and resume normal life. And we knew, you know, from the early 1990s, I say to you now, you know, there's 6 million people in South Africa who have HIV. You don't blink an eyelid, really. But back in the early 1990s, when the epidemic was new, and we were saying to people, listen, this epidemic could be as big as 3 or 5 million people, nobody actually believed us. We could see that it was coming. We could see the devastation that HIV was going to bring to communities and families. And for me, there was also a direct connection between seeing that and having just stepped out of a fight for equality and human dignity on the basis of equality of race. Now there was this other thing. I can't say, okay, job done, when I know that job isn't done because there's a new threat and people are not grappling with that new threat.
One of the perhaps interesting or slightly humorous parts of the book is when you mention how you took over at the AIDS Law Project. Mm. You started leading that, and you describe how you weren't a lawyer. This is a public interest law group, effectively, and you just sort of had to run with it.
Yeah, I didn't. since it's a lesson for young people today to step up and take big responsibilities. Look, the AIDS Law Project did not have a head for a couple of years. It had been directed by Zaki Akmat, but Zaki Akmat left to do other things. And so eventually I thought, well, somebody has to direct this thing. I have a vision of a social justice organization. I have a feel about the role this type of organization can play. I believe I can build a team for this organization. But I didn't know anything about law. I'd never studied law. In fact, I'd rejected law, because for me as a Marxist, law was often described as part of the capitalist superstructure of society and nothing that can ever have any use for poor people or working class people. And I also knew very little about HIV or about running an NGO or a CBO. So I took over very, very unprepared. I had the right frame of mind, but very few of the tools that would be needed to run a legal organization.
Now, I hope this isn't too sensitive, but you write in the book about how you tragically lost your first two children. Can you tell me, how did that motivate or affect your activism?
Look, it's not... I put it into the book deliberately because it did motivate my activism. Because I'll come to the personal tragedy in a second, but if you remember, we started building the treatment action campaign in particular around the issue of easy medical interventions to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV, because at that point in the late 1990s, 70,000 kids were being born with HIV a year, and most of those children died within a year or 2 years, and sometimes a little bit longer. So that was why we had this campaign, what we called the PMTCT campaign to prevent mother-to-child HIV transmission. But for me, the loss of a child was not a theoretical or academic issue. It was something that I could very personally relate to, because in 1995 and 1996, my partner Sharon, our first child, and we were in the heat of activism, in the heat of the struggle, and we just assumed that, pregnancies were generally without complications. That's what most people assume. And at a very late stage of the pregnancy, we discovered that the boy had hydrocephaly, which is essentially water on the brain, and at 36 or 37 weeks, we had to terminate that pregnancy, which is a nightmare. I mean, I can't really describe the hurt and the horror and the pain, particularly for Sharon. And then a year later, the same thing happened, but this time actually due in some ways to medical negligence, because this time a healthy baby girl ruptured the scar of the year before's pregnancy, and because there weren't anaesthetists available and nobody had expected anything to go wrong, the baby ruptured the scar and died in the course of birth, and that was there's nothing wrong with that little girl. So, those were horrendous years for me, for Sharon, but I felt what it was like to be a parent, to lose a child, and in particular, I saw what it was like to be a mother, to lose a child, and the mother's experience, because she's the person who grows and develops the child and develops deep emotional bonds even before a child is born, the mother's attachment is so much deeper. So I think that for me was always a reason why I needed to fight on this particular. I knew the pain and I knew the other people's pain.
How difficult was it writing this book, balancing your personal story with aspects of history, politics, analysis? It can't have been easy throwing all these things together.
It wasn't. I'll tell you, if you don't mind, just very quickly, the story of the book. I do mention it, but I'll be very quick. When the first draft of this book, or the first attempt to write the book, what I was trying to write really was more a kind of story of politics and more a sort of theoretical analysis of social justice struggles and what could we learn from the work of the TAC and the AIDS Law Project and so on. And I did this draft and I gave it to a publisher who gave it to a reader, and the reader came back and gave me a big shock by saying, listen, this is boring and this is turgid and it's dry and nobody will really want to read it. So I had to chuck that draft completely. I was shocked for a few months. I was saddened. And he said, make the same points, but try to tell it from your own experience by telling your own story. And I started doing that. And actually, Greg, the second time that I started writing this book, it flowed much more freely and much more easily. So yes, it does splice and mix history and politics and literature and love and music and all of those things. But for me, they fit reasonably easily together, because one of the main messages I'm trying to get across in this book is that it's human beings who wage struggles for social justice, and the belief in social justice and the willingness to sacrifice and commit to social justice must come from our deepest emotions and instincts. It must come from a sense, often from a sense of joy in the beauty of civilization. And it must come from, okay, I've joyed. Why can't that person have the same joy? And I guess I'm trying to bring some humanity. I'm trying to stop people like me being seen as some sort of cardboard archetypes, and get people to understand where activism comes from and where activism should mm-hmm. should go back to.
Mm-hmm. Just very quickly, working with the TAC, you and a lot of other individuals very closely involved in the organization won some huge victories, particularly on the rollout of antiretrovirals. But they were very hard fought and extremely intense battles. Mm-hmm. When you look back now and you look at the denialism of former President Thabo Mbeki, his people like his health minister, Manto Tshabalala Msimang, even I think it was last year when Mbeki continued...
2 months ago.
Recently,
a month ago, very recently. Yeah.
Essentially continued his denialism. And we've seen studies that where that policy effectively caused the death of 330,000 people that may not have died or likely would not have died if they had have introduced antiretrovirals earlier. How do you feel now?
Well, the AIDS epidemic is not over. And one of the things that we're thinking a lot about at the moment is fears that the AIDS epidemic may actually be about to return with some vengeance, because of our failure to prevent new infections, because of our failure to manage things like tuberculosis, and because of the weaknesses in the health system. But South Africa need never have had the scale of HIV crisis that we have, that we're confronting today. And what we're confronting today is still directly related to the failure of Thabo Mbeki as president of South Africa, not just his failure, to his active propagation of ideas that confused people, to his active standing in the way of policies required by the Constitution that could have saved lives and prevented deaths and prevented HIV infections. So one of the things I am trying to do in this book, and it's partly about my personal need to get it off my chest and to get it recorded for all time, is that this man must not be forgiven. Certainly not forgiven until he has admitted his complicity, direct complicity in hundreds of thousands of deaths and all of the pain that was associated with that. So I want, even if Thabo Mbeki feels that he can appear, reinvent himself as a urbane, intellectual, thoughtful political leader and a constitutionalist, I want to be saying to society, hold on a minute, just because you're desperate to find that sort of person somewhere, don't go looking for it in Thabo Mbeki, because he may not be a Jacob Zuma, but many of his traits have as deep social consequences as what Jacob Zuma has been doing to us in the last few years.
I'm going to read you a passage from your book, and with questions that you've posed to yourself. So you write, "Two questions keep me awake at night. How can it be that when so many people know what's wrong with our country and the world, when there are so few people who defend the status quo, we continue to career down a path to destruction? What holds us back from building organizations that will bring social justice and equality?"
Well, I guess we could spend another hour talking about that. I mean, one thing we can't say about our situation in South Africa or the world is that we don't know. We can't say we don't know about climate change and the consequences of climate change further down the line. We can't say we don't know about the inequality. We can't say we don't know how to reconstruct society to make it more equal, more fair. I struggle every day as I walk down the streets at the two worlds that you see with left eye and right eye. One is a world that is actually very comfortable in itself, that has gadgets, that has modernity, that goes to clubs, that is happy. And the other world is a world that is denied all of that and that suffers. And how does the world that has everything accommodate itself? How does it close its eyes to so much that is going on the other side of the street? And when are we going to wake up as human beings and discover that we have a common destiny, that we have a common brain, a common capacity to feel pain, a common capacity to joy? I don't know. I think we're in a bit of a bind in how we, in a vision to fix our world.
One of the ways you've been trying to fix our world is with an intense focus on organizing and coalition building, coalitions within civil society. Yeah. Obviously, the Treatment Action Campaign was quite a good example of that. Then you've also been involved with the Awetu movement, the Anti-Xenophobia March, as well as the Anti-Corruption March. I'm not sure if you're a part of it, but you've watched NUMSA try to push its United Front. And currently you're involved with Save South Africa, which, maybe tell me if I'm wrong, but you're trying to get the president removed or for him to resign, as well as try to reform other aspects of our politics and negative tendencies and systems within our politics. Firstly, why is this coalitions of civil society necessary? And can you tell me very briefly about some of the immense challenges that you're faced in trying to build such civil society coalitions?
Well, I think one of the interesting new characteristics of the 21st century, as opposed to, say, the 20th century or the 19th century, is this idea of the power that resides in political people and the power that resides in civil society. And by civil society, we mean non-governmental organizations, non-governmental people who challenge power and who fight for equality and justice. You know, I've been doing that certainly all of my life since I kind of stepped out of the liberation struggle and into the civil society space. But, you know, I've worked on HIV and I've worked on health more broadly and I've worked on the right to basic education and I've worked on the right to food. But as I work in each of those siloed areas, what I see all of the time is the interconnectedness between the issues and how often deprivations in access to healthcare services are linked to decisions that are made about budgets, about economy, about fiscal policy. And so part of my quest, if you like, and I'm not alone in this, is not to want to dissolve 100,000 different social movements and civil society organizations into one big homogenous thing, but is how can we get them to work together and present a kind of popular people's front on these key questions of power? How can they form a political force, not a party political force, but how can they form a political force that exerts influence on political parties that sit in parliaments, on presidents, on the private sector, on the private business sector? And I think that is the way we have to go. So, you know, I've done what I can in the last, particularly the last 4 or 5 years since we formed Section 27, to try to see, to experiment with building coalitions, to try to experiment with getting people to see the points that they have in common with each other and not just the points of difference. But it's not easy. But it's not over yet either.
Some of the movements you've been involved with have been criticized as white or elites. How do you personally grapple with issues of race and class privilege, and does it affect your work?
It does affect my work all of the time, and I write in the book, you know. I am a white, middle-class person. White people have a lot to answer for, both in South Africa and a lot to answer for in the world. You know, as a white person, I subscribe to the principles and ideals of non-racialism that were developed in the 1950s and the 1960s by people like Ahmed Kathrada, Nelson Mandela, and other people's principles that I think even people like Steve Biko subscribe to. But I think people of privilege, whether it's privilege based on race or privilege based on class, have got to be prepared to make sacrifices, have got to be able to put their shoulder behind the wheel of struggles that are led by working class people, led by poor people, led by black people. And that's what I'm trying to do. That's what we did when we were trying to build the TAC. You know, we tried to build the TAC as a movement of poor people, of people living with HIV, of women. But it does seem to be a contradiction at the moment, Greg, and it's something I battle with every day, that it's not untrue that a lot of the noise at the moment is being made by elites, and that sometimes the elite noise and the elite protest, and that's not to say that it has a hidden agenda, by the way. It's not to say that the elites are trying to protect capitalism or white monopoly capitalism or whatever. But if you look at the class character often of people who are starting to gather, to protest, to think, it is people from more privileged parts of society. The revolt and change is going to have to come from people who have really been dispossessed by 21st century modern South Africa, 21st century world, because it's only there that there is sufficient anger to force a deep and radical change. And then we are all going to have to think about what that change is and how to constitute the change. So again, you know, this is a short interview. It's a hugely complex question to which I've probably given quite a shallow answer. So really, I'm just saying I'm very conscious of those questions, and they're difficult, and you grapple with them every single day.
Coming to the end of your book, you grapple with quite some difficult issues. And one of the things, you seem quite hopeful, and even in this interview you've mentioned that people are inherently good, or the good outweighs the bad. But you also say that us as individuals, and perhaps our lack of empathy, our inaction, is the biggest problem in confronting some of these huge societal issues. How do you grapple with that balance, and how do you do that without becoming cynical?
Well, if you work with ordinary people, you will never become cynical. One thing I've never risked in all my years of doing this is cynicism, because you draw passion, you draw inspiration, you forced to learn about new things all of the time, you forced to try to understand the people around you, the good people and the bad people who are around you. So cynicism is not something that I feel at risk of. I do believe that if we can work out really what are the key knots that we need to untangle, and I'm not sure if we do understand them, particularly when it comes to movement building and building of power, that we can unleash good, that we can struggle towards social justice. I say in the book that I think that poor people have more power, more political power, more legal power than at any point in history, certainly on paper. How do we start to invoke and to use that power? You know, we are dominated and dictated to by minorities, whether they're minorities based on capitalism or anything else, because we permit it, because we've grown to accept the unconscionable, to tolerate the intolerable. You know, just as Steve Biko in the early 1970s, you know, had to bring into being the notion of black consciousness, which was in part saying to black people, listen, you're not slaves, this is not the natural order of life, as apartheid tells you. You are equals, so stand up and assert your equality. If you don't accept that you are equals, then you're never going to fight and overcome this. And the same applies on the issue of class. If you live without a toilet, without water, without electricity, you send your kid on a daily basis to a school where she may be raped, where she doesn't have teachers, if you accept that you're going to die in a hospital or that you're going to be deprived of medicines in a clinic, if you accept that this is your lot, if you accept that this is the natural order of things, then nothing is going to change. So there's a big mind shift that has to take place. There's a new type of consciousness that has to be brought into being if we are going to get out of the mess that we're in.
Mark, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to the Daily Maverick Show. I've had Mark Haywood in studio today. His new book is Get Up, Stand Up, Personal Journeys Towards Social Justice. Thank you for listening. Download and share the podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Show on CliffCentral.com. This is CliffCentral.com.